Hello, pals o' mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. It's funny the impressions of famous people or characters someone will spring on you. An old boyfriend looked at me one night and dove right into the cowardly lion. Cracked me up. Why did I leave him? If you have a few impressions or dialects up your sleeve and have considered a career in acting or voiceovers, Ed Giles Jr., whose credits include stage, film, television, radio, and live improvisation, provides a few tips that may assist you in honing your craft.
So what are some of the diverse gigs you've been hired for?
In terms of voiceover, I've been done a couple of commercials here and there. For example, there was one that I was doing for a plumbing company where I was Ed Norton from The Honeymooners.
Nice. You got to do that real quick.
Oh, okay.
I've got to hear Ed.
Hey, way to go though, Ralphie boy. I don't know if I blew out the microphone. I apologize if I did, but sometimes I got to remember to pull back if I get really loud.
I'm now pulling the mic closer to me.
I used to perform on stage outdoors a lot, so I can tend to get loud, but I'll try to pull it back for this interview today.
Project.
Yes. Also, I got a gig from the Lodge in Gilpin Casinos in Colorado, where through Nakamoto Productions, they were looking for somebody that could do a variety of character voices. What they wanted to do is have a jackpot announcement from a different movie character or pop figure and have them congratulate them for winning the jackpot in that voice. So,
fun idea.
Yeah. So I was given this list of characters, everyone from Arnold Schwarzenegger to Don Corleone. Let's see, who else? Dirty Harry, Chief Brody from Jaws. About 20 different characters that they wanted me to record. The only one I wasn't able to do was Judy Garland. I tried. I was like, no, can't quite pull off that. Oh, Toto, without sounding too off of her. But every other one I was able to do, they liked them. And so now if you're hitting a casino in Colorado, you might hear me congratulate you if you hit the jackpot. So.
Hey, that's Ed.
Yeah, well.
So what was your first official paid gig? How old were you, or young were you?
It was right out of high school. I was auditioning as a senior in high school for a Students Against Drunk Driving, California CHP Don't Drink and Drive campaign at the time. And I think I learned one of my most important lessons about acting for the camera in that is that I was there, this was in the late 80s, so everyone was wearing acid wash jeans and knit sweaters and had the preppy look going on. At that time, I was more into Hawaiian shirts. But, you know, like, before they kind of came into vogue, I don't know if they ever really came into vogue at some point, but...
Well, Magnum P.I.
Yeah, that's true. And I wasn't really doing it for the Magnum P.I. thing. It was just, I'd reached a point in my junior year where I just don't want to try to copy everybody else because I'll never be cool on my own. I will never pass off as being cool. So you know what? If I'm going to be uncool, I'm going to be uncool on my own terms. So I went in with the Hawaiian shirt and I read my bit and I did it. And then I went for callbacks where I was competing against from everybody in the Sacramento area region. And again, just this nicely dressed people. On that day, I actually wore an orange shirt with tiki masks all over it. I did my line, I said it, and then I got hired for the commercial bit. I think I got paid maybe $100 for that day of shooting. But basically they said, when you come back, bring that shirt. So it was different people fading in and out and speaking about someone whose friend had been killed drunk driving. And then what I did in my little bit, I just stood there and I smiled and I nodded the camera before fading out again. So even though I didn't say anything, I realized image is oftentimes what gets you cast. It's not necessarily about the amount of talent you bring to it, but oftentimes it's about how you look for the camera. Now, this is not to discount anything in terms of people being talented, because talent is the one thing that's going to get you beyond the door. Maybe your looks will open the door for you, or maybe something about your physical presence, but working hard and persevering will then turn that open door into an opportunity to go down the hallway and get to the next room, and then get to the next room. And as you work with people and they know what your work ethic's like, that's really where it takes you.
Makes me think of Tootsie. Remember, and Dustin Hoffman was trying everything to get the roles. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't be any taller. Right. You want a woman? Fine. I will become a woman.
Right. And you know, that's a good lesson for flexibility, too. But I think that in my experience in any type of performing, whether it's voice work, camera work, stage work, it really is about putting in the hard work and the commitment and building connections with other people. And if you can do that, then you'll find that people will want to work with you more in the future.
And did you take formal classes insofar as stage work and camera work, you know, where your spot was?
I actually have an associate degree in theater arts from Kissimmee River College. I worked with an excellent acting teacher, Dennis Wilkerson. He passed away in 1999, but I learned so much from him about commitment to a piece, about being honest and open in your performances and trying to get away from the superficiality of quote-unquote acting and really getting into what it means to honestly portray a character. Then I was fortunate to work with Frank Condon at River Stage, based out of Cosumnes River College, as I was getting my degree. And he came from Los Angeles, San Diego area, had a wealth of experience and was a great teacher and be able to pull different things out of you and able to construct a world and make real believable characters. A lot of intense work. If you've ever seen Frank Condon's work, terrific. I learned a lot from him both as an actor and as a director. So I have that under my belt. I've been performing on and off over the last 25, 26, 27 years now.
You indicated that you worked in Colorado. How far have you traveled?
Oh, actually, I recorded it here in Sacramento.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they were actually, I guess, doing a nationwide search for someone to do the voices.
So and you have a...
One of the studios here. I actually recorded at Nakamoto Production Studios.
So you don't have your own.
Right. I have a home recording studio, which is a very portable. I set up this little box with sound insulation. I have a little microphone in there. So if I need to record something for an audition or a quick piece that I can send someone over email, then I've got a little booth where I can do that. But a lot of times, if I have a working with someone who has a recording studio, I'll go there and use their studio.
I met one young gentleman who said he records in his closet because that's the quietest place he can find.
What I have to do, and I take up a lot of space, so I can't really fit into the closet with everything I've been there, but I'll find a quiet room, turn off the air conditioning, and just pray that somebody doesn't drive by blasting their music because I'm recording through it. But yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, you can have, if you have a laptop, a microphone with a USB cord, a nice quiet place, you can actually record. And if you've got the right software, you can edit your own stuff, get it ready to send out. And I've done that a number of times too.
Like Audacity, that's free.
Yes. And I also use Logic Pro on my computer. So I've been using that and playing around a little bit with video editing, but that's more of a hobby than it is actually a marketing tool for myself.
And of course, voiceover versus stage or film work, it's a disembodied voice, so
yeah.
They can't see you. So
right.
That really is a technical skill.
It can be. In fact, I approach them the same way. That, of course, when you're doing voice work, you're also inhabiting a character. Whether that character is simply making announcement and relaying information for such as 0% financing. You got to be clear with that. You're also informing them that as a character, you're coming from a point of view, and that point of view is making sure the customer understands what it is that they're getting. But if you're taking on a character like Ed Norton from The Honeymooners, and maybe Ralph Cramden has a backed up sink or something, you inhabit that character, you have your goal to help your buddy out, you know, that type of thing. But I think that the approach is really the same, because if you understand both physically how the character stands, that can inform how your voice comes across. If you know the quality of the voice, of course you can inhabit that. But if you also know the text and what's being delivered and why it's being delivered, that can also color the way you make your delivery too. In doing, for example, commercial work, if you know what it is the company wants to get across to their audience, you can help tailor your performance in that way. And if you're playing a character who needs this product, say, for example, if it's an exterminator and, oh no, there are bugs in my house. What should I do? All right. That's not somebody who's really bothered by bugs. Like, oh no, there are bugs in my house. What should I do? You know, add that enthusiasm to it or that panic or whatever it is, something that an audience can relate to, even if it's over the top and in a comedic way. You get the audience's attention and then they listen to the commercial rather than flipping over to the next channel.
Have you done books? Audiobooks?
I did one audiobook recording privately for someone in the family that I know, and we're waiting to see if that gets recorded too, but that was more of a practice run for myself. As far as professional, not yet. I am open to that, but right now I am focusing on character voices, where if somebody's looking for, say, a recording for something that's animated or impression, that type of thing, that's where my marketing's kind of going right now. But I'm open to pretty much anything anybody wants to do.
I downloaded an audiobook from the library for my walks. It was a Carl Hyacin book. It was Artie Johnson was the narrator. It was the worst. It was boring. There's no inflections from different characters, somebody even talking, like he just didn't give a shit. He was like, get my money, let me get out of here. I couldn't make it past 5 minutes. I had to turn it off and just return it. It was horrible. And clearly, Artie Johnson has that whole laughing background. It's not like someone just yanked him off the street. There's a reason he was hired. But that's another example how I think the average person doesn't realize that there is a talent, whether it's a natural gift or learned, with voices.
Yeah.
It's not as easy as you think it is.
A lot of it comes to the text and studying the text and looking at the text. This is something actors do when they're memorizing. They'll look at the text not only so they know the words that they're going to learn, but also understand the motivations of the characters, why they're asking this question, where the conflict is coming in. Another thing actors will do is they'll look at a specific sentence and decide where the emphasis is going to be. What's the key word in that sentence? What's driving behind it? What's the meaning? If you've got text and copy, whether it's a story that you're reading out loud or whether it's a 30-second commercial copy that you're reading, it's always good to look at the text, break it down, find out what words are key, what word drives the sentence, what drives the meaning, what drives the intention of the person who's speaking. So if I were to, I'm looking right now at a sign that's on our table, and it's a list of guidelines, and I could just simply read it. I'll just pick a line at random. The group study room hours will be the same as the library opening and closing hours. Okay, I just read that. If I were to go like that for 5 minutes, he'd fall asleep. But if I know what's key here, we're looking at hours, at the times that they're going to be open and closed, so I'll know which words to emphasize. The group study room hours will be the same as the library opening and closing hours. So I put a slight emphasis on hours, same, opening, and closing. So what you're doing is you're helping the audience to understand what's key. You're saying the entire sentence so it sounds natural. You're not speaking in fragments, but you're putting emphasis on those specific words. So when you've got text in front of you, take a moment to look over the text, break it down into sentences, break it down to thoughts, beats, find those key words, find the ones that need the emphasis to make sure that whoever your audience is, whether it's somebody who's stuck in rush hour traffic and just trying to make it to the next exit, or whether it's somebody who's sitting at home with their eyes closed in a dark room, listening to this wonderful, fantastic story unfolding in their imaginations, you'll know where to put the stress, where to put the emphasis, how fast to go, how slow to go, and tailor it to create that mood or get that attention from the audience member that they want. And find the variety so it's not at the same level every time. Find out when to slow down and when to speed up, and how to draw their attention by getting louder or quieter by drawing them in. You can kind of get a feel for the variety there.
Yeah, my dad loved reading to me when I was little. I mean, he really got into the characters. And so when my nephew was really little, I read him The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. And he started getting really scared. He goes, I want mommy to read it. And I look over at my sister-in-law and she goes, I'm really a boring reader. So he's used to just the middle of the road. There was no evil character voices. And So I thought that was pretty insightful insofar as children and access that they have to voices and audio besides cartoons and movies.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I would prefer to read a book out loud than read it close to myself because I wanted to be that character, whether the character was the hero or was the villain. I just had fun with those types of books.
Let me hear some examples of celebrity voices that were villains.
That were villains.
That are in your voice stable.
Well, I don't know if you could consider him a villain necessarily, but there is Don Corleone from The Godfather, and you can't see it, but right now I'm pinching my cheeks because I don't have the cotton balls to stuff in my mouth like Marlon Brando did. But this is a classic villain, a classic voice that people usually recognize and hopefully understand.
And then if you were to go with, say, a cartoon villain, one of my favorites is Marvin the Martian.
Where's the kaboom? There was supposed to be an earth-shattering kaboom.
And then you could always do some Snidely Whiplash or just generic villain character. Yeah, any type of villain character is often low and sinister. And if you slow it down, the villain is enjoying and savoring how the plan is coming to fruition. Of course, the hero rushes in and he's bold and he's quick and he wants to dash the villain to pieces before his plan can unfold. But not so fast. I'm going to catch you in this trap, so you are forced to hear me talk about the plan I love so much.
So let's go to the other end of the spectrum.
Sure.
Any light characters like children's stories, fairies, or you mentioned Dorothy earlier, Judy Garland, the good witch Glinda, or you know, something light, you know, because not all heroes are
right
that exaggerated. Sometimes they're like Prince Charming, say.
Oh yes. If I were to adopt a British accent and speak softly and quietly, I, of course, could be the very dashing hero, quite possibly a villain, you never know. But there are, within each role, you can have a very heroic, quiet character, you can have a very villainous, quiet character. And oftentimes, it's a matter of inflection, but when you're doing lighter characters, of course, you think about not only the psychology of the character themselves, but also the psychology of the person hearing the character, how they're going to react. So if I were supposed to say, I cannot possibly pay the rent, or I cannot possibly pay the rent, or I cannot possibly pay the rent. You see, those different voices have different attitudes when you're listening to them, and I can only imagine the people listening to the podcast not seeing how my face is being conveyed, still coming away with an attitude that each character voice has to say in that particular line. So oftentimes, softer characters may be interpreted as meek, quiet, young, but it also could be someone who's sneaky and just trying to get around where they can get into that person's pocket and take their gold from their purse. Who, me? Oh, no, that couldn't have been me. I'm too small and weak.
Remember we were kids, one of the road trips, and Dad asking my brothers and I, the three of us, to say one line five different ways. I don't know why I remember that. Maybe because it was so random out of left field. We weren't... How many white cars can you spot? You know, boring, you know, kids that are bored. But it is true. It's a great exercise, I think. And it also gives you great perspective when you're watching movies or listening to an audiobook or cartoons for that matter. Because a lot of these cartoons aren't even called cartoons. They're animated features.
Right,
which actually require another aspect of acting, voice acting. And of course, there are dialects. One of my first introductions to crazy dialects was Sid Caesar and Peter Ustinov, which I think are the two, nobody's really topped them for just making up a language that sounded like something, but it really wasn't.
Right, gibberish.
What dialects do you have in your stable that come naturally to you, and which ones did you have to kind of study a little bit?
It's funny for me because the more I do an accent, the more comfortable it becomes. But at the same time, I'll switch to different accents. And sometimes I just have to remind myself of the rules of each accent, because I'll be honest, sometimes my Spanish slips into French or vice versa. When I'm doing improvisation, it's not as much of an issue because it's very much adopting a comedic character. But when I'm doing a serious role, I'll often sit down, I'll look at the word, I'll break down the diphthongs, the vowels, the consonants, and make notes to myself to remind myself, okay, is this accented or is this not accented? Right now, I feel pretty comfortable with the standard British because I use it a lot. I've done a lot of Shakespearean plays. I did a play last year where I was portraying two characters, one who was very British and intellectual, another one who was very French and from the gut. And oftentimes having to jump back and forth between the two characters within the same scene. And that was difficult for me at first, but as I was memorizing the lines and knowing which line was the British and which line was the French, gave me the opportunity to break down each line as it were. And so as I came out, it was easier for me to speak through. But if you're going to study a particular language, there are certain rules to them, especially coming from America. And of course, America has several different accents. There's the California accent that I speak in that I'm not even aware of. There's the Southern California accent, Texan, Deep South, New York, etc. I mean, if I were to start talking maybe more like a Brooklyn accent, something like this, this is something that comes a little bit naturally to me. But if I had to think about Boston, I'd really have to kind of go back and study it.
They've got a little nasal. I remember meeting a gentleman from Boston, and he says, "Get out of here." Yeah. He sounded like Billy Clyde from All My Children. I remember laughing.
And the letter R seems to be key in so many different dialects, because sometimes you have a hard R, like if you're speaking in a Texan accent, you really overemphasize the R like that. And then with British accents, sometimes it's the first R that's good, and then the throwaway R is just kind of after that, like... if you were to say laboratory, we're hitting the R's, we're hitting the accents, but British, it would be laboratory. And so, laboratory, you really don't hear the R's that much. Most of the consonants turn into schwas, so the throwaway consonants as well. I'm sorry, the vowels. The vowels are throwaway vowels. You hit the labor, that second O, bor, laboratory. And the other vowels just disappear after that. Yeah, again, it kind of goes back to studying and prepping for it. If you're in an improv situation where it's totally fine to make mistakes, maybe your accent goes back and forth and someone on stage, "Hey, weren't you French 5 minutes before?" "Yes, I was, but my passport just came through, so I'm an American now." You could play around with that. But it's, again, in the world of improvisation, you just accept everything, and it's fun to make mistakes and fall flat on your face. When you're doing it in a stage presentation, you study, you prepare, and you just make sure that you've got everything right. When you're going to record audio for a 30-second commercial, preferably you'll be coming into the recording studio knowing what accent they're going to want you to speak in. It's good to have a few in the back just to be ready in your toolbox. So if you kind of get surprised, "Can you try it with a British accent?" "Of course, I could definitely give it a try. Let's see, it's have a spot of tea then, it won't." That type of thing. But
I remember seeing this old Life magazine article, and it was with Louis Jourdan, mm-hmm. who's having to learn English. And there's individual photo stills of him with his lips pursed, trying to get the American accent, and it was pretty, pretty cute. You're teaching classes, mm-hmm. so what is Dialects for Dummies? And you've covered that a little bit. So you also teach step by step how to perfect impressions. So can you give us a sample of that, a taste?
Sure. Three workshops that I was teaching this summer. The first one was character voices, where I was really showing people who were new to voice acting how to use their mouth, their tongue, their throat, even their nasal passages to create different sounds, and through those different sounds, different unique characters. So maybe they talk high and nasally like this, and everything is resonating through their nasal chamber. Or maybe they speak very low and their larynx drops down. Their voice box is in their chest as opposed to in their throat. So things like that where you can manipulate your tongue, your cheeks, your jaw to create a different sound. That was really the jumping off point where we're going with that first class. The second class is going to be playing around with accents. And I teach the way that I find effective as a student, what works for me and how I can pass on those techniques to others. So I will look at a particular accent. I will look at the commonalities between how the vowels work versus the consonants, how diphthongs work, which is basically two consonants that run together next to each other, like glowing, G-L, that's a diphthong. And are they pronounced separately? Are they broken up as two different sounds? Do they run together like we normally do? And I'll look for the differences between how we speak standard American or California accent in this case, and how is it different saying the same word in the same pattern of words. What you find is that over time, as you practice, your mouth develops a specific, what I call a shape, where perhaps with a British accent, your lips are forward more and your lips are tighter and your jaw is not loose and hanging down and your tongue is more forward. So when you start speaking like this, even if you're improvising and you're not reading something that you've prepared, you can get to a point where you recognize the shape of your mouth when you're talking and you recognize those patterns as you're speaking. So you know where the G is hard, where the G is soft, and you know which vowel to accentuate and which ones to just let go. And so it becomes natural over time the more that you practice with it. I first started learning British accents as a kid listening to Monty Python skits, which might not have been the best because they use so many accents within the United Kingdom and you think you're learning one but you're really learning several. But that's why I learned my Pippiport voice.
I have to tell you, when I was going to a junior college and I took this acting class, and periodically we'd have to act out a scene, and so I did a scene from Pygmalion, and the only English, because I was 19, so the only English accent I knew was Haley Mills. So that's the only, you know,
right.
It wasn't even close to being Cockney, and the teacher just looked at me just disgustingly and said, "We don't need Pollyanna in this role." I was so embarrassed, but I didn't feel that bad because I didn't know Cockney. Didn't know any, and I hadn't heard of Monty Python at that point. Otherwise, that would have been a great reference point. You learn as you go, right? I think a great exercise for people that want to learn how to read out loud correctly to tell a story would be to volunteer their time at, say, a retirement community or assisted living, and short stories, mm-hmm. not a full book, and act out the different characters that inflex, and the people that will be listening to you are enjoying your presence and reading.
Right.
They're not going to be judging you, and it'll be fun for everybody.
I think that's any opportunity to speak or read in front of the public is going to be great, because even if you find that you mess up somewhere, if you're dedicated to it, you'll ask yourself, how did I mess up? Why did I mess up? And when you get to when you're asking yourself those questions, you have the curiosity to learn about how to make yourself better as a result. And as you figure out how to fix things, you learn. And yeah, whether it's reading for groups where it's very low pressure to be able to read for a volunteer group, because first of all, they love the fact that you're there and that you're going to be doing something that everybody's going to enjoy. You're going to enjoy it. They're going to enjoy it. So it's very low pressure. And I mean that in the most positive sense, because you're there to entertain people. You're there to tell them a story, to take them to a different place. Now, if technically in the back of your head, you didn't know what word to pronounce because, oh, how do you pronounce this? And you take your best guess with it and you go on with it. 98% of the people there aren't going to notice. And even if they do, there's going to be like, did they say that right? Oh, doesn't matter. Here's this wonderful story. I'm going to keep going with it. But as a performer, you take that moment And I'm the type of person who always kicks themselves repeatedly over those little mistakes that nobody else cares about. It's like, but I'm going to go. I'm going to look. I'm going to figure out how to say that word right so I say it right the next time. And I know how to pronounce that unfamiliar word. But yeah, if whether or not you're reading a story to a group of people, adults, children, whatever, maybe you have an opportunity to give a presentation at work. Maybe it scares the heck out of you, and that's okay, because knowing that you're scared means that you care about it. If you are looking to develop the skills to public speak, maybe you're someone who wants to but gets butterflies. I completely understand that. That happened to me a lot as a kid, and even sometimes as an adult. I get really nervous about things. It's about finding a comfortable environment in which it's okay to fail. It's okay to make mistakes. And finding a group that will not only accept those mistakes, but ideally having an environment where if they could point out those mistakes, not in a way of saying, you did this wrong, but more, here's how you can make this better, and giving positive, constructive feedback on how to do those things. I spent a number of years with Toastmasters International, and that is a wonderful group for people learning public speaking together, whether it's giving a toast or a presentation or simply talking for a minute or two off the top of your head on a random topic you don't know anything about. You learn a lot of great public speaking skills through that. There are also acting classes that are available. There are improvisation classes for improv groups. And yes, I know I'm teaching a workshop. I'm not trying to push this as a plug for that. But any opportunity you get to try something out new that you want to give a shot, classrooms are great because you get to fail and you get to learn from those fails. And not having that fear of failure and being willing to make those mistakes so you can learn from them, you'll get more and more confidence to go along.
Because we're sitting at the library today, I also want to point out that they love to have volunteer storytellers for the kids, because nobody is going to be a more honest audience than children. So speaking of kids, can you give us a Looney Tunes sign out?
That's all, folks.
All the world's a stage. Do something different. Order a root beer float or banana split.